Whenever you're ready, counsel.
May it please the court. I'm Merk Patinos. My attorney registration number is 35732. With me today is Alexander Rothrock. We're of the law firm Burns, Figa, and Will, and we represent the Hannon Law Firm, who is the plaintiff, excuse me, and appellant in this case. This case is an attorney fee dispute between attorneys. It's not an attorney fee dispute between an attorney and a client. And in this case, the Hannon Law Firm is seeking recovery and restitution. It's not seeking to recover a contractual fee, either under a fee-sharing agreement or under a contingent fee agreement. Those two distinctions are critical for this court's analysis because they provide the background for the position that we take that this court should uphold the trial court's denial of the defendant's motion to dismiss and reverse the granting of summary judgment against the Hannon Law Firm. There are three points that I hope to make today. The first is that Hannon Law Firm's claim accrued in 2004 upon recovery in the underlying lawsuit, and not in 1998 when the Hannon Law Firm withdrew from representation. The second point is that Hannon has a right to recovery in quantum merit against the defendant law firms, even though the clients were the primary beneficiaries of the services that Hannon provided. And the third point is that the rules governing contingent fees have no application to fee-sharing agreements. With respect to the first point, when did Hannon's claim accrue? The position that the defendant law firms have taken, an application of the New York rule, is that Hannon's claim accrued in 1998 when Hannon withdrew from representation. The better law for Colorado, because the Colorado Supreme Court has already taken steps toward the California rule, is that Hannon's claim accrued in 2004 when there was a recovery in the underlying lawsuit.
Well, counsel, I'm having a little trouble following your argument. You pointed out correctly at the beginning of your argument that this is a lawsuit between two law firms and not between a law firm and a client. The New York cases and the California cases are all cases between a client and a law firm. How are they applicable to the accrual of a quantum merit claim among co-counsel not involving a client?
Your Honor, Chambers versus K, which is a California Court of Appeals decision, is a case between two attorneys. In that case, what the Court of Appeals did was apply the rule that relates to the accrual of claims between an attorney and a client to a claim between an attorney against another attorney. And what the court there did was took the rule in Ficassi versus Brent and it applied it to a claim between attorneys.
But the policy considerations for accrual of a complaint against a client are not present here. The courts are concerned about a lack of resources on the part of the contingent fee client. They're concerned about a disparity in power between and abilities between an attorney and client. Those considerations are not present here, are they?
No, Your Honor, they're not. There is not, when attorneys are involved in a fee-sharing agreement, there's not a disparity of sophistication. But what that issue really goes to is whether the rules governing contingent fees should apply and bar a quantum merit claim. That issue was one that was raised. It relates to the motion to dismiss, not to the accrual of the statute of limitations. But what's important there is that that's exactly the point that we're making, is that because there's not a disparity of sophistication between attorneys, there's no reason to apply the rules governing contingent fees to a fee-sharing agreement.
I may have gotten ahead of your argument, counsel, but part of the problem that I'm having with this case is there's very little discussion of the statute, 1380-108-6, the accrual statute. Why isn't this just a statutory construction case? Why are we arguing all these policies when the statute tells us what the policy is? The policy is to avoid stale claims and to bar stale claims. How does, you know, your argument that we should adopt these policies with regard to unjust enrichment, et cetera, how does that address the statutory language? It says a cause of action for breach of any express or implied contract accrues when the breach is discovered or should have been discovered by the exercise of reasonable diligence. Why aren't we looking at when reasonable diligence would go into effect instead of these policy arguments?
With respect to the accrual of the claim, the issue is when was there a breach of the implied agreement? The trial court didn't answer that question because the trial court never analyzed when the third claim of the unjust enrichment claim was satisfied. They said that Hannon provided a benefit to the defendant law firms, and upon provision of that benefit, the claim accrued. But that skips the most important step of analysis in determining when the claim accrues, because when the claim accrues is when the breach of implied contract takes place.
And well, that's what I need you to focus on then, is when the breach of the implied contract applies. Because in 1998, it's pretty clear from the record that your client knew that they filed an attorney's lien and knew that these amounts were owed, correct?
That's correct.
So why, if they're required to exercise reasonable diligence, why aren't they required to make a demand and file suit shortly thereafter, after they know that the money is owed?
And Your Honor, that's the point that you're raising is why there's a split of authority on this issue. That in New York, they've said, we think the attorney needs to sue right away. In California, they've said, we need to wait. And it's because the arrangement between the attorneys doesn't happen in isolation. It happens in the context of representation of clients, and there are strong policy reasons for delaying until there is a recovery.
But there are also strong policy reasons for not delaying. And the justice delayed is justice denied, and so forth. Stale claims, our courts have been very clear that you're not supposed to allow stale claims to go forward. How do you counteract that?
That the claim wasn't ripe to go forward until there ultimately was a recovery. And that's the Colorado Supreme Court, through the rules governing contingent fees, has already taken a step toward adopting the California rule, because in the context of a dispute between an attorney and a client, the attorney can't bring a claim in quantum merit against the client unless and until there's a recovery in the underlying lawsuit.
Well, but we were just saying that the same policy considerations that apply between an attorney and a client don't apply between attorney and attorney. So how, isn't there a disconnect there?
I don't think there's a disconnect, and there's not a disconnect in New York, and there's not a disconnect in California. What I mean by that is that in New York, when an attorney sues an attorney, the claim accrues upon withdrawal, not upon recovery. And when an attorney sues a client, the claim accrues upon withdrawal and not upon recovery. In California, it's just the opposite. That a claim against a client accrues upon recovery, and a claim by an attorney against another attorney accrues upon recovery. And if this court adopted a rule where Hannon's claim accrued upon its withdrawal in 1998, we would be unlike the states that have adopted the New York rule, and unlike the states that have adopted the California rule, because there would be conflicting accrual provisions. And the reason that the policy reasons behind application of a delayed accrual are just as important in the attorney-attorney context as they are in the attorney-client context. If Hannon had filed suit either against the clients or against the other attorneys in the middle of the underlying litigation, that can jeopardize the client's underlying case, because
it doesn't have to. Can't you do it under seal, or can't you file a motion for stay?
You absolutely could. There's no guarantee that the motion for stay will be granted.
True.
There also is no guarantee that staying the case will keep it from becoming stale.
What about filing it under seal?
You could file it under seal, but until you have a recovery in the underlying case, it's not possible to evaluate the reasonableness of the fee that's sought. One of the primary.
I'm sorry to interrupt. I have a more basic question here. When Hannon withdrew, wasn't that tantamount to a saying that you're in breach? I'm not satisfied with my role in the litigation. So the breach of contract between attorneys happened at that point.
That's an issue that needs to be resolved by the trial court. At this point in the proceedings, the And as the defendants have pointed out at footnote 7 on page 23 of their opening answer brief, the facts as alleged, Hannon justifiably withdrew. That's one of the thresholds that Hannon has to get past in order to recover in quantum merit. If Hannon abandoned the case, he doesn't get to recover. But if he justifiably withdrew, he does get to recover, and that is a reason for remanding the case to resolve those factual issues. At this point, either in the record or in the case, it's not possible to determine that.
Say unequivocally that your client would not have a claim if there had not been a recovery?
Yes. And that's because the expectations of the parties. One of the levels of fact finding that has to go on at the trial court level in an unjust enrichment claim is to look at the expectations of the parties. When Hannon got into this case, Hannon expected to recover, if there was a recovery in the lawsuit. If Hannon's claim were to have accrued upon its withdrawal, it filed suit, but had gone forward under seal, there's a possibility Hannon could have recovered and the non-withdrawing attorneys didn't recover. And that's not how the risk allocation was set out when they began the representation, and it's inconsistent with the expectations of the parties when they began representing the plaintiffs.
That's your position, there needs to be fact-finding to sort that out.
That's correct. And that's because of the nature of quantum merit claims. They're not really great claims for being resolved either on a motion to dismiss or on a motion for summary judgment, because inherent in those claims, there are unique factual circumstances to each quantum merit claim. The relationship between attorneys is one of those unique circumstances, and that's why we're asking this court for a particularized rule for analyzing the third element in the context of an attorney fee dispute. And that's because there's no law in Colorado directly on that point, and we sit in a place where there's a split of authority. And the final, I'd like to make one final point and then reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal, and that's that the rules governing contingent fees have no application to fee-sharing agreements. The rules themselves apply only to contingent fee agreements. They apply to arrangements between an attorney and a client for the provision of legal services, not for the division of fees. And while the defendants at page 4 of their reply brief say that indisputably Elliott versus Joyce and Rule 5D of the rules governing contingent fees bar Hannon's claim, there's no case that says that. Elliott versus Joyce doesn't say that. Dudding versus Norton Fricke doesn't say that. Mullins versus Hansel Henderson doesn't say that. And the policy reasons for behind providing notice to clients of the possibility that they may have to pay in quantum merit doesn't apply to attorneys.
Thank you. Good afternoon, judges. My name is Joseph Bennett. My attorney registration number is 16290. I'm here today on behalf of the defendant law firms in the case below, Millat, Pressman and Higby, and Howarth and Smith. I see this case really as a case that should have been decided on the 12B5 motion. So I'd like to start by talking about the 12B5 motion, and I'll talk about the statute of limitations issue second if I could. Mr. Hannon's position is that there is some special relationship between the attorneys in a fee-sharing agreement that allows him to recover a fee under circumstances where he would not be able to recover a fee from a client. And so I think that in order to evaluate that, you have to consider where a legal fee comes from. Legal fees don't come from a fee-sharing agreement. Legal fees in a contingency fee case come from the contingency fee agreement. And the Supreme Court has drawn a very bright line on the circumstances in which an attorney who is not entitled, or when an attorney is entitled to a quantum merit recovery. And what they have said is that in order for an attorney to get any recovery at all in quantum merit, that attorney must give the client's notice, and he must give the notice in the fee agreement itself. it's absolutely clear, and Mr. Hannon does not dispute this, that if there was no fee-sharing agreement in this case, this would be an absolutely easy case to decide. It would be decided on Elliott versus Joyce grounds, and we would have to go no further. And so the first question you have to answer is, why does the fee-sharing agreement change that rule of law? Why does that change anything? I submit to you that it does not change anything. If you read the rules regarding contingent fee agreements, it is absolutely clear. Rule 1 itself states that a contingent fee agreement not only covers the relationship between the client and the attorney who signs the agreement, but it also applies to associate counsel. So it doesn't matter whether Mr. Hannon is in a fee-sharing agreement with other attorneys who may have signed the fee agreement. He's subject to the fee agreement too. And that is also clear from Rule 1.5 of the Rules of Professional Conduct related to division of fee agreements. The rule requires that an attorney's right to recover must be based on having performed work for the client and conferring a benefit on the client. And so the attorney, in order to get a fee, has to look to the client for the fee. The division of fee agreement merely assesses how much of the fee that is earned goes to each attorney who has earned the fee. And I would also point out that comment 7 to Rule 1.5 defines a division of fee as a single billing to a client by two or more attorneys in different firms. And so, you know, you have to read all of this stuff as a whole. You can't just, you know, sort of pick out the parts of the law that you like and ignore the parts of the law that you don't like.
Well, Mr. Bennett, your opponent is contending that they're not seeking an attorney fee per se. They're seeking something closer to restitution under quantum merit. And they're also contending that the documents, whatever they are, among counsel and with the client, are unenforceable in this instance, and therefore they're entitled to sue for quantum merit. Now, there's some backup for that in the law. And if what they're suing for is not under the documents, not under the contracts, but instead under quantum merit for restitution, why does the contingent fee rule have any applicability whatsoever?
Well, first, Judge, I would point to the complaint in the case. They have not alleged a breach of contract between among the attorneys. Mm-hmm. What they have done is they've alleged a right to quantum merit. And I would submit to you that what they are really saying, though, is that there is a breach of contract. What they are saying is Mr. Hannon was subjected to some unreasonable demands by his co-counsel, and as a result of that, he had to withdraw. He had no choice but to withdraw.
Well, I have to tell you, their complaint looks more like a bricklayer coming to and suing the homeowner for saying, I laid the bricks, you got to pay me for the benefit that you received, because they don't make reference to direct reference to suing under any of these agreements.
Well, except that they were not hired by the homeowner in this case to lay bricks. They were hired by a client to pursue a environmental tort case, and they didn't pursue it.
Right, but if let's say Milad hired an expert witness who provided expert testimony, and there was no written agreement between them, or no enforceable written agreement between them, couldn't that expert say, I conferred a benefit on you, law firm, and I'm suing you for quantum merit to pay me?
So if the attorney, if the expert witness reviewed the case, agreed to testify, and then didn't show up for trial, he'd be entitled to a fee? I don't think so.
That wasn't part of my fact pattern.
Well, but I don't see you saying, that
if the expert witness did a report, let's say, for Milad, but didn't testify at trial.
Well, but that's
there's some
like,
work done that benefited the attorney.
The way you laid out those facts, it's more like the case of the Mullins case, where the attorney has actually completed what he was required to do. And in that case, the Supreme Court has said that even if the fee agreement is unenforceable for other reasons, the attorney is still entitled to a fee because he's done what he contracted to do.
But there's no requirement in those cases that you absolutely have finished the work. You can confer a benefit based on some of the work that you did. Isn't that true?
That's certainly true, but I also think that you have to look at where the benefit runs. And Rule 1.5, I think, makes clear that you earn a fee when you confer a benefit on a client, and that's because that's where the fee comes from.
In a multiple counsel situation, let's assume that one lawyer is going to do one job, another lawyer is going to do a different job. And before they get to the final point of presenting the case at trial, one lawyer withdraws, but he's got great outlines on exactly how to cross-examine a particular witness. And those outlines are used by the remaining attorney. Are you saying there's no benefit conferred on the attorney?
I'm not saying necessarily that there was no benefit conferred, but what I am saying is that that's not what the attorneys have contracted to do for the client. And when attorneys...
But why are we focusing on what the attorneys contract for with the client when the claim is not by Hannon against the client? The claim is Hannon against another
because
firm.
Hannon's only right to attorney's fees comes from the contingent fee agreement. If the contingent fee agreement was violated, he's not entitled to a fee under Colorado law.
That's a factual question for a jury or a fact finder to decide on the merits. Why does that relate to whether they've got a claim for relief?
It's not a factual matter. They've conceded that he's not entitled to a fee under the contract. They've conceded that he withdrew from the case before the contingency was achieved, and there's no provision in the contract that allows him a fee under those circumstances. So it's not a factual dispute on that. He's not entitled to a fee under that contract. The question is there something about a fee division contract that changes that rule? And I submit that this is nothing more than an end run around Elliott versus Joyce. And I'll be the first to admit, I do contingent fee work. Elliott versus Joyce can result in some harsh results. Sometime in Elliott versus Joyce itself, the attorney did not get a fee for all the work he did on the case. In Dudding versus Norton Fricke, the attorney did not get a fee.
That's predicated primarily on public policy reasons to protect the client. There's no question the client was protected here. The client has not been sued.
Well, the client has not been sued, but that does not mean the client is not affected by the way the fee is divided among the attorneys. The clients contracted with attorneys to see their case through, and they only contracted to pay fees to a lawyer if the lawyer saw the case through, or alternatively, if they terminated the agreement with the lawyer. They did not contract to share fees with a lawyer that did not complete the work. And the Supreme Court in Elliott versus Joyce said, if you don't put it in the fee agreement, you can't get fees. And it's a harsh result in some cases. And you may think it's a harsh result in this case. I don't know. I don't see it that way. I have a hard time believing that an attorney who is working on a case that may be worth millions of dollars in attorney's fees decides he's going to walk away from the case 2 months before trial because somebody asked him to do a deposition on short notice. And that's basically what Mr. Hannon is saying. And so I don't really feel that the result in this case is all that harsh. But I do think it is a result that is anticipated by the Supreme Court's decisions. And Mr. Hannon could have avoided this whole problem by insisting that something be put in the contingent fee agreement that would have allowed him to seek attorney fees under these circumstances. I would like to, unless you have any questions further on this, I do want to address the statute of limitations issue.
Just one thing before you get there, Mr. Bennett. Would you agree that if the trial court's judgment on the statute of limitations issue were affirmed, that there would be no need to address your cross appeal?
That's true, Judge. It is, however, I think, an important you can decide the case on one issue or the other, but I think it is an important issue, and it's an issue that could arise in other cases potentially, although I do admit that this is a little bit of an unusual case. But on the statute of limitations issue, Judge Terry, I think you hit the button in your comments about Rule 108, and I do think that this really is, I think, when you get right down to it, an allegation that Howarth and Smith or Don Howarth somehow breached the agreement among the attorneys by making it difficult for Mr. Hannon to stay on the case. And that is really a breach of contract claim. The Supreme Court in BP America versus Patterson held that in all cases governed by the three-year statute of limitations, then the accrual rule set forth in 1380-1086 applies. And what that says is that a cause of action for breach of any contract shall be considered to accrue on the date the breach is discovered or should have been discovered. It's absolutely clear that Mr. Hannon knew in April of 1998 that he had, arguably had a claim of breach of contract. So the discovery would have been.
Did he have one claim or two claims? Because one claim might be that somebody breached the contract, Mr. Howarth, perhaps. But the claim for recovery of a fee was not against Mr. Howarth for that conduct. The claim was, we want to be given a reasonable fee based upon the benefit we conferred before we withdrew.
Well, that is a different issue than what I was addressing. And if I can just have a minute, I will get to that. I think that what Patterson says is that if there's a breach, the discovery rule applies. And I think as of April of 1998, it's clear that Mr. Hannon knew that he had some sort of a claim against the defense, or against Mr. Howarth, and that's what it was, a breach of contract type allegation. But the issue that you raise actually goes to the elements of quantum merit, and that is the third prong of the quantum merit, which is the unjustness question, and when does it become unjust? And I really think that is the same factual issue as we just discussed. And that is, when does it becomes unjust? When you're forced off the case. And that's really what Mr. Hannon is saying, is I wanted to stay on the case and share in the case, but I was forced out. Well, that's unjust. If that's true, that's unjust. And so why would you wait? Why would you have an accrual occurring 6 years later when the case settles? Settlement is not an element of quantum merit. Settlement is just a potential factor in determining damages. You can determine damages with or without settlement. And so
would it be unjust for Hannon to recover a fee based on quantum merit if there was no recovery for the client whatsoever?
If in fact he was forced off the case, yes, sure. I mean,
really?
Sure. Where's
the money coming from? Co-counsel has to fork out money from their own pockets, not for costs, but for attorney fees because of work another attorney did, even before there's any kind of realization of the contingency.
If in fact the contract was breached by Mr. Howarth, if damages, flowed from that breach, then sure, Mr. Hannon could. Maybe, it might be reputational damages, I don't know. But there may be some kind of damages that flow just from the breach. I'm not saying he would have been entitled to millions of dollars, but sure, why not? Don't breach of contract cases get filed on those kinds of grounds all the time? I think they do. So I would just close by saying that I know that in some cases it's harsh. But the law in Colorado, I think, is very clear on these subjects. I think the trial court was correct on the statute of limitations. And I also think that this case should have been dismissed on our Rule 12b-5 motion. So I would ask that the trial court be affirmed.
Well, there are two points that I'd like to make. The first is that
In this type of situation, there cannot be an accrual of a claim until all three elements of the quantum merit claim are satisfied. And that can't happen here until there's ultimately a recovery. The best place to look for that analysis in Colorado is not in case law, but it's in the rules governing contingent fees, where the Supreme Court has said that an attorney can't represent can't recover from a client in quantum merit until there ultimately is a recovery in the underlying lawsuit. We're asking this court to apply that rule to a dispute between attorneys because it's been done in California, and it's also been done in New York. The second point that I'd like to make is that this court has adopted a policy in Norton Fricke versus Turner of keeping clients out of lawsuits between attorneys. And that's exactly what happened here. By waiting until there ultimately is a recovery in the lawsuit and the money is transferred from the clients to the counsel, clients don't have to be locked up in a battle between attorneys. They've already gone through whatever harm it was that led to their lawsuit. They've gone through the litigation process, and this helps to ensure that they don't have to be involved in a third and a second case and even more difficulties. And what that helps to do is ensure that clients, as a matter of policy, can have faith in the legal system. The other thing that happens is that if the claim accrues upon recovery and not upon withdrawal, we'll have fewer lawsuits. For those reasons, we believe that this court should hold that Hannon's claim accrued upon recovery in 2004 and not in 1998, and reverse the trial court's grant of summary judgment and remand it back to the trial court for further findings on really what is the central issue in this case. And that is, did Hannon justifiably withdraw? If he justifiably withdrew, he gets to recover. If he abandoned the case, he recovers nothing. And that's consistent with the expectations of the parties when they began representing the clients.
Address opposing counsel's contention that this is simply the backside of Elliott versus Joyce and that you shouldn't be allowed to recover under these circumstances. You don't have a claim for relief because there's nothing in the fee agreement about quantum merit as it relates to this particular aspect.
Yes, Your Honor. When I began, I said this is a dispute that is about restitution. And quantum merit, may I run over? My time just ran out. The issue is that Hannon is conferred a benefit, and the question is whether it was unjustly retained. Under LaSavia versus McDivitt and Murdoch versus Cohen, even though the clients were the primary beneficiaries of the services, Hannon still can recover in quantum merit against the other law firms. And that's the reason this is not an end run around Elliott versus Joyce.
Thank you. Both for your arguments this afternoon. The case will stand submitted. We'll get you a written opinion in due course. That concludes our docket for the afternoon. The court will be in recess. The beta can be signed.
All right. The court will be in recess. So I'm going to call.